So it begins. The impeachment trial is officially underway, and Democrats are laying out their case against President Trump.
President Trump withheld hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to a strategic partner at war with Russia to secure foreign help with his reelection. In other words, to cheat.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and today on The Takeaway for January 23rd, we hear how the trial might play out over the next few weeks. Also on the show, journalist Glenn Greenwald speaks for the first time on U.S. radio since being charged with cyber crimes in Brazil.
But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you go into journalism, these are the kinds of stories you want to do. And if you want to confront power, inherent in that is that you're going to be subjected to attacks and risks and danger.
Plus, how Muslim women are taking charge of ongoing protests in India, and a look at abortion reversal laws taking hold in areas around the country. Lots to get to. Let's get it going on Capitol Hill.
Shall we begin?
Pursuant to the provisions of Senate Resolution 483, the managers for the House of Representatives have 24 hours to make the presentation of their case. The Senate will now hear you.
President Trump withheld hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to a strategic partner at war with Russia to secure foreign help with his reelection. In other words, to cheat.
The evidence shows that President Trump unlawfully withheld military assistance.
He raised the so-called CrowdStrike conspiracy theory that Ukraine, not Russia, had interfered in the 2016 election.
President Trump was publicly signaling his interest in the investigations.
Rudolph Giuliani is a cold-blooded political operative for President Trump's re-election campaign.
A new poll shows not only are Americans sharply divided when it comes to whether President Trump should be removed from office, but a sizable percentage, 14%, say they don't know enough to have an opinion.
At the end of the day, I believe without question the President of the United States will be acquitted.
Adam Schiff continues to make the same arguments over and over again. For any of you that's covered this in the House, today was not a new day. It was just a repeat and a repeat and a repeat of the same things that he has been saying for a long time.
When it comes to Donald Trump, they're willing to destroy the institution of the office in the name of getting him.
I'd love to go. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be beautiful? I don't know. I'd sort of love to sit right in the front row and stare at their corrupt faces. I'd love to do it.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Arun Venugopal, in for Tanzina Vega. House Democrats are laying out their impeachment case against President Donald Trump in the Senate. Led by Representative Adam Schiff, the House managers presented aspects of their impeachment case late into Wednesday night, accusing the president of using his power to pressure the Ukrainian government into helping him cheat his way to re-election. The president's defense team will have to wait until the Democrats wrap up their opening statements to outline their case against impeachment. Only after both sides finish their arguments and senators ask written questions will lawmakers be able to vote on whether to subpoena witnesses. For more on this, we're joined by Jennifer Habercorn, who covers Congress for the LA Times, and Max Kuttner, journalist covering impeachment, the Russia probes, the FBI, and the Justice Department. Thanks to you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Max, let's start with you. House managers are laying out their opening arguments without any challenge from other senators or from the White House legal team. Is there anything fundamentally different between what they're arguing this week versus what we heard during the impeachment hearings in the House?
Arun, the House process obviously was working towards impeachment. This now in the Senate, this is working towards removing Trump from office. So this is a lot more consequential. And what we heard yesterday from the House managers, that was a lot of what we did already hear and what was in the impeachment investigation report. However, if this process continues, if the Democrats are allowed to call witnesses, review new documents, then this will be a much newer process. Also, starting as late as Saturday, we will be hearing from Trump's legal team, and that we did not get during the House process.
Max, we're still waiting to hear opening arguments from the president's legal team, but we do have a sense of what their case will look like based on a trial memo that they filed. What stood out to you in that memo?
So they are expected to make procedural arguments. They're going to say the House process was biased. So far, this whole impeachment process has been structurally deficient. That's the wording that they used. Then they're expected to make legal arguments. They'll say these articles do not violate the law. They don't stand up to the bar of high crimes and misdemeanors. And then they're expected to make political arguments as well. In the memo, they said that the Democrats are, quote, held hostage by a radical left wing that has foisted on their party an agenda of socialism. That sounds more like the kind of thing we'd hear at a Trump rally and not so much in a legal document. So I do think, especially depending on which of his legal team members are presenting these arguments, we are going to hear a bit of that. We are going to hear this being used as a time to promote Trump in maybe a more political way than a legal way. But mainly they're going to attack these two articles and say that they don't stand up. This isn't what the framers of the Constitution intended.
Now, one of the members of his legal team, Alan Dershowitz, has been pushing the argument that the president needs to be charged with an actual crime to be impeached. But most constitutional scholars don't agree with that, correct?
And what's interesting about that is that seems to be attacking the process, the legality of this whole process, and less so the actual facts here. So that is less disputing what happened. It's more just disputing that we should be even having this argument to begin with.
Now, let's hear from Chief Justice John Roberts, who's presiding over the trial in the Senate. He had some pointed words for House impeachment managers, as well as the president's defense team.
I think it is appropriate at this point for me to admonish both the House managers and the president's counsel in equal terms to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. One reason it has earned that title is because its members avoid speaking in a manner and using language that is not conducive to civil discourse.
The world's greatest deliberative body, nothing like a little triumphalism at a time of severe dysfunction in Congress. Jennifer, why did Roberts feel the need to speak out there?
So that was on Tuesday night. It was getting pretty late at that point. I think it was about 1 a.m. And lawyers on both sides were getting pretty testy. Jerry Nadler said that the Senate was engaged in a cover-up by not participating in the witness subpoena process. That really rankled Republican senators. They told me yesterday that they were really offended by that comment. But the president's lawyers responded as well, kind of going after Nadler. So there was a bit of back and forth between them. Obviously, at that point at the trial, the lawyers were going up one after the other. So we are seeing both sides, unlike right now when we're, you know, we really have the presentation from House Democrats 3 days in a row, and then Trump's lawyers 3 days in a row. So that happened, and the Chief Justice made this admonishment. And frankly, a lot of senators said this was a good idea from the Chief Justice to try to tamp down the temperature. And in fact, yesterday, the tone was a lot more somber. Adam Schiff, the lead House impeachment manager, started the day yesterday by, you know, really laying it on thick for senators, thanking them for their time and their patience the day before. So perhaps they're getting closer to that world's greatest deliberative body.
Well, so far, Jennifer, the Senate hasn't voted to allow witnesses to participate in a trial, but the impeachment managers have been playing video clips of several key witnesses who were part of the House inquiry, like Gordon Sondland and Fiona Hill. Is re-airing those clips helpful to the Democratic strategy here?
You know, I think it may be. I've been in the chamber, in the press gallery, watching a lot of the arguments yesterday. And I mean, senators were watching the video shown on two television screens in the Senate. So House Democrats might not be able to get those witnesses to testify live in front of the Senate or even in a new deposition, but they're making those witnesses' testimony known to senators, and that could have an effect. Senators are in that chamber for long hours listening to Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and the other House Democrats talk, but they're seeing the testimony from those witnesses as well.
Max, there was speculation this week that a witness deal, that is the testimony of Hunter Biden, son of Vice President Joe Biden, for someone like former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Democrats shot down those rumors yesterday. Where does that leave the likelihood of testimony from officials like John Bolton?
Well, I don't think that much has changed in the past 24 or 48 hours since the senators initially said that they were not going to allow the body to subpoena these new witnesses, subpoena for documents. They are going to be considering those motions to do so again after these two 24-hour periods, after the arguments, that is. So if anything changes, then there will be that opportunity to call those witnesses. A lot of Republicans were speaking to reporters yesterday saying that that would only drag out the process. And so it seems unlikely that that will happen. And certainly Democrats yesterday were saying that, as Adam Schiff put it, this isn't a fantasy football trade. There's not going to be this sort of witness trade. And so without any sort of leverage or a trade-off, I can't imagine Republicans changing their minds from what we found the other day.
Jennifer, the rules governing impeachment proceedings are pretty outdated. Senators are supposed to remain in the chambers for the entirety of the arguments in the trial. Have they actually been following these rules?
Pretty much, yes. We've seen a lot of senators kind of get fidgety and antsy, and they go stand up in the back of the chamber, or they're passing notes with their colleagues or getting candy. But yeah, the rules are pretty outdated. They can only have milk or water on their desk, no coffee. There were actually two senators that I spotted with milk, which I was not really expecting, Senator Tom Cotton and Senator Richard Burr. And, you know, we saw Dianne Feinstein left about an hour early yesterday. Her spokesman said that she wasn't feeling well, but for the most part, senators have been in there. But the breaks are kind of increasing as we get later into the day.
Now, it is easy to feel entirely cynical about this process. On the inside, does it feel like that, or does it feel like people are genuinely grappling with these arguments and trying to do right by Congress?
You know, a little bit of both. And I've asked some senators that, you know, they repeatedly said, you know, this is a really somber process, this is my constitutional duty. But at the same time, we're leading toward a conclusion that seems pretty well spelled out. I mean, there's no one who thinks the president is going to get removed from office. There are, you know, there's a little more thinking that we could actually get witnesses, but that seems pretty a pretty high bar as well. So there is a bit of a feeling that the, you know, die has been cast and this is a fait accompli, and senators are just going through the motions. So it's definitely not as clear as, you know, that firm constitutional mission that, that some senators are making out to be.
Max, what are you going to be looking for in the next few days?
So arguments today are going to be about the legal background of Article 1 of impeachment, which is abuse of power. Tomorrow, the Democrats, the House managers, are expected to discuss the legal arguments about Article 2, which is obstruction of Congress. So they're going to be laying out not just the timeline of events, which is what we've previously heard, but the legal arguments behind them. But then I'm really looking forward to hearing from Trump's legal team, because this is new. We haven't heard this. We did not hear this during the House process. In fact, the legal team has even pointed out we didn't hear from the president or his team during the process. But all that said, Republican senators really want this to wrap up as soon as possible. And so we could be looking at just another week or a little bit more than a week of this.
In terms of certain senators like Lamar Alexander, where do they stand in terms of the ability to finally get more witnesses in there?
Well, I don't think there's going to be much of an opportunity to hear from more witnesses. The Republicans the other day really seemed opposed to that. The Democrats have said they're not willing to do a witness trade. And so there might not be a lot of new information. And I think that's the fear of Democrats, because then it really just becomes a reiteration of what we already heard during the House process.
Jennifer Habercorn covers Congress for the LA Times. Max Kuttner is a journalist covering impeachment, the Russia probes, the FBI, and the Justice Department. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In India, protests continue against a law passed over a month ago that grants citizenship based on religion. Critics say the law openly discriminates against Muslims. Women, in particular Muslim women, have been on the front lines of the protests and show no signs of slowing down. But the continued conflict has come at a cost. Amid alleged police brutality, thousands have been arrested and around 30 people have been killed. Here to explain the latest on these protests is journalist Barkha Dutt, author, journalist, and Washington Post columnist. She's been covering the situation from Delhi, India. Hi, Barkha.
Hi, Arun. Pleasure to be on.
Remind us exactly why this law, the Citizenship Amendment Act, has generated so much anger in the country.
to understand why the citizenship legislation is so contentious and so divisive, one has to understand that it allows fast-track citizenship to non-Muslims from three Muslim countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh. And for the first time ever in India's history, you have a kind of religious exceptionalism, a religious filter being applied to the notion of citizenship, and therefore many believe to the very idea of the Indian nation. What weaponizes this new citizenship legislation is a proposed second law, which hasn't been executed yet, called the NRC, which stands for the National Register of Citizens. This is what the BJP government wants to impose nationally, and this will require everybody to prove that they have the documents to show that they are legal citizens of India. And what a lot of us believe, and a lot of the protesters believe, is that this could lead, one, to the poor having to prove their citizenship many times over, because often they're the ones without documentation. And two, we might see Muslim migrants being the only ones in internment camps, and we might see India's Muslims being even more pushed to the margins than they have been politically in the last few years.
And we're also hearing reports of one or more detention centers being built, correct?
They have been built in one particular state of Assam, which is an eastern state in India, which is where this NRC that I mentioned, the National Register of Citizens, was ordered to be executed by the Supreme Court. And that has been the government's defense that the citizenship project in the eastern state of Assam was in fact mandated by the judiciary. But once it took place in Assam and didn't quite go according to the ruling government's plans, because suddenly they found that there were at least 50% Hindus among those who found themselves off the rolls and without papers. And so even the Modi government wants a recount there. But once they imposed this citizenship project in Assam under the orders of the court, they started talking about doing this nationally. And they first brought in the citizenship legislation as step one towards achieving this. So I just want to clarify, detention centers have been built in the state of Assam. You have a minister in the government that actually told India's parliament that 28 people have died in this detention center in Assam since these detention centers were built. And nationally, we have as journalists seen an internal government order that speaks of building these kind of detention centers in other cities of India. This has not happened thus far, but we have seen a kind of proposed order that speaks of it.
These protests are happening across the country, and they've been taking place every day for over a month. What do you think has sustained them for so long?
What's very, very interesting is that I see these protests as an attempt to reclaim nationalism. We live in an age where there is one particular phrase that is used for anybody who goes against the dominant political narrative in India, and the phrase is anti-national. If you disagree at all with the dominant narrative, you're called a traitor, you're called treacherous, you're called anti-national. And in Hindi, there's a phrase that is used for a lot of dissenters called the Tukre Tukre Gang, which means people who want to see the country being broken to bits. Now, you would imagine that this is a very volatile and kind of dangerous phrase to use against someone who doesn't agree with you, but that's what's been happening. And what we see at these protests is a kind of reclaiming of the nation. And you will see this in the symbols that are being used. You will see the Indian tricolor everywhere. You will see the preamble to the Indian Constitution being read out at all protests. You will see the architects of India's freedom movement, in particular Mahatma Gandhi and B.R. Ambedkar, the Dalit scholar who was the architect of India's Constitution. You will see those posters. The students are marching against the new citizenship projects. They're marching to reclaim the constitution. And they're also marching against brutalities that took place against students in the form of police excesses and excess force on several of the campuses where these protests erupted. So in many ways, this is not an opposition-led movement. It's a people-led movement. And it's a movement that's being led by India's young and also by India's women, in particular, India's Muslim women.
A few days ago, you were at Shaheen Bagh in New Delhi, where you interviewed Muslim women in particular, some of whom were dressed in the colors of the Indian flag. What were they telling you about their presence there and why they're so motivated?
You know, Shaheen Bagh has become India's version of Occupy Wall Street. The context is very different, but it is the same sort of spirit where you have this people-led, women-led vigil, and it's now been more than a month. Shaheen Bagh is a nondescript neighborhood in India's capital, Delhi. Where the women sit night after night, often in plummeting temperatures, is a bus stop. And you kind of go through these narrow alleys and back lanes of a bustling bazaar. It opens up to this sort of compound space where there are, you know, just under very simple tents. You have all of these women sitting and you have a small stage where people are welcome to come and make speeches, men and women both. And of course, this is essentially, I would say, a lower income neighborhood. The women, many of them are educated, many of them are old, some of them are young. I've met a woman protester as old as 90 years old. I've also met, 18-year-olds. Typical evening at Shaheen Bagh would be sometimes tens of thousands of women, their little children, the Indian flag painted on the faces of these children. Some babies are asleep under the blankets. Everybody kind of huddles together. And there's a lot of speeches and poetry. And what's really intriguing is that although these started off as protests, the atmosphere is very celebratory. It's almost like a wedding. There's cups of tea and there's biryani being cooked at the back. And I like to say, because it's a women-led vigil, everybody's asked, have you eaten? Don't go without eating. So, you know, it's very different from how men would run protests.
Yeah. I think for some of them, they told you that this is a way not just to assert their democratic rights, but also it's pushing back against the stereotype of Muslim women as being downtrodden, correct?
Yes. So the very interesting thing is that, you know, if you were to deconstruct this in terms of a feminist debate, there could be a million views because many of the women are in complete parda. You know, some are behind the burqa, some are not in either a burqa or a hijab. So it's quite multicultural. And one of the posters there actually had a woman wearing a hijab and also wearing a bindi, which is the traditional ornamental forehead vermilion sort of paste that Hindu women use. And the poster kind of had both and just said, does it matter? And I think what women were trying to say is that, look, you can park all your other debates for later. We're here collectively to fight a much bigger battle, and that is for our country, our place in the Indian Union. And, you know, repeatedly women have, in fact, said this to me, that the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, when he was legislating against the triple talaq custom, which is a custom which allows instant divorce by simply saying the words, talak, talak, talak. At that, you know, he made the argument that Muslim women must find their voice. Muslim women must be given the space to express themselves. And these women, more than one, told me that, look, the Prime Minister said we must find our voice, and here we are. This is our voice.
So how is the Prime Minister responding to these protests?
Prime Minister so far has not directly engaged with any of the protesters. It's not as if he's called some of the students over or called some of these women for talks. Instead, you have seen the government doubling down on the new citizenship legislation. Prime Minister and his very powerful lieutenant, the Home Minister Amit Shah, have accused journalists like myself of offering a kind of selective narrative. And I think that the government calculates, despite these protests, that there might be some electoral advantage for it in parts of the country. They seek to present these protests as Muslim protests, and thereby they believe, I imagine, that there would be a consolidation of the Hindu vote as a counter to these Muslim protests. Hence, you will see that at Shaheen Bagh itself, there has been a great effort to underline the secular nature of this agitation. There have been interfaith songs. There have been people of all religions. There have been people of all communities who have come and shared the stage, because I think there's an attempt to say that, yes, although this is a vigil led by women and Muslim women, it doesn't speak only for Muslims. This isn't just Muslims speaking for Muslims. This is Indians speaking for the possible disenfranchisement or marginalization, if you will, of India's Muslims.
From the Indian point of view, is it significant that this is getting international attention now, especially against the backdrop of an economy that's really not doing as well as many people think it should be doing?
So I think the economy is the headline there, right? I think the Indian, or perhaps the government thinking, has been that as long as India remains a sort of critical market, the world's media may sort of carp a bit, but the governments need India's business and they need India's market. But if the economy continues to nosedive and doesn't recover, then I think that leverage that India as an emerging superpower of this region has enjoyed will diminish. And therefore, I think how the world reacts and how India counters that is going to depend very much on how the economy performs.
Barkha Dutt is an author, journalist, and Washington Post columnist. Barkha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
On Tuesday, the Brazilian government filed a criminal complaint against journalist Glenn Greenwald, alleging he helped hack the cell phones of public officials. Prosecutors are demanding Greenwald be charged in relation to an investigative series he worked on that exposed ethical violations, corruption, and politically driven convictions by Brazilian prosecutors and a high-ranking government official. The Intercept, the news organization Greenwald helped found, began publishing these stories last June based on a trove of leaked private chats, audio recordings, and other documentation. Greenwald is best known for his work exposing widespread surveillance practices by the U.S. government, based on documents leaked by whistleblower Edward Snowden. U.S. lawmakers and press freedom organizations have spoken out in support of Greenwald, warning that these charges could lead to broader attacks on free speech under the government of far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. So, here to discuss this in his first U.S. radio interview since a criminal complaint was filed, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald, co-founder of The Intercept. He's with us via Skype. Glenn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Tell us exactly what the Brazilian prosecutors are alleging regarding your role in the investigation published by The Intercept and The Intercept Brazil.
So the expose that you referenced at the beginning were enabled by an anonymous source who came to us with a large archive of communications and other secret documents exchanged between high-level Brazilian officials that he said he had hacked. By the time he talked to me, he had already obtained all of this material. They are nonetheless accusing me of being a participant in the what they're calling an organized criminal organization based on their theory that while talking to the source asked me whether or not he should be deleting the conversations I was having with him. I explained to him that I couldn't give him any advice. But that I did have an obligation to protect him as my source and that I was saving all communications and there was no need for him to save them because I was keeping them in a secure place for my own protection and his. The federal police concluded their investigation 2 months ago and said there's no evidence that I committed any crime of any kind. They even pointed to that specific conversation and said this is proof that he always used professionalism and caution to avoid involving himself in any potential criminality. But the prosecutor, who's known as being a pro-Bolsonaro, far-right prosecutor, prone to abuse his power, has the opposite theory, which is that when I said, oh, you don't need to worry, I'm keeping copies of all of our conversations, that I was implicitly giving him a wink-wink form of advice to destroy the communications and therefore made myself part of the criminal organization.
And when exactly did these communications happen?
The source first contacted me on Mother's Day of 2019, which, if my memory serves, was May 11th. And I spoke to the source over the course of the next several weeks as we prepared our stories and as he uploaded the materials that he had obtained, first onto my telephone and then ultimately onto the servers of The Intercept. So it was during these two or three weeks of conversations when we were preparing our stories and working with our source that I was speaking with him.
Prior to the criminal complaint issued this week, a Brazilian Supreme Court justice actually went so far as to order the federal police to stop investigating you in this case. Why did the judge feel the need to take that measure in the first place?
Well, from the beginning, the Brazilian government has made clear that they don't believe in a free press at all. The president of the country, Jair Bolsonaro, has spent 30 years advocating for a return to the military dictatorship that ruled the country until 1985. He has often railed against press freedoms. And shortly after we started our reporting, our exposés that had as their primary target the justice minister, the very powerful justice minister of the Bolsonaro government, Sergio Moro, news leaked from his office that they had initiated an investigation into my personal finances, which everybody knew, obviously, was in retaliation for the reporting. And so a center-left political party in Brazil went to the Supreme Court and petitioned the Supreme Court for an order barring any investigations into me relating to the reporting that I was doing on the grounds that it was a violation of a free press. And the Supreme Court accepted that petition and ordered all eight law enforcement agencies, including the prosecutors, not to investigate me in any way. in connection with this reporting on the grounds that it would be an attack on a free press and a violation of the constitutional liberty of press freedom. And this, the judge that issued that ruling is now very angry and publicly saying that what this prosecutor did was a clear violation of the Supreme Court order.
So just to, for those of us who live here in the U.S., who it sounds like this is basically a political or a constitutional sort of struggle that's playing out there. Is it between the Supreme Court and other branches of government?
Yeah, I think that people in the U.S. And more broadly in the West have sometimes had trouble understanding the true nature of the Bolsonaro movement and President Bolsonaro himself, in part because the Western media spent 2018 referring to him as the Trump of the tropics, as though he was just kind of another Donald Trump. And people look at the U.S., where Donald Trump is president, and obviously see attacks on democracy by Trump, but nonetheless see a functioning, healthy democracy in the U.S., and conclude that Bolsonaro must not be that threatening. In reality, he's nowhere near Trump in terms of the threats and menaces he poses to democracy, in part because Brazilian democracy is much younger than U.S. democracy and therefore much more fragile.
Glenn, before we let you go, how are you and your family doing?
You know, I think it's, you know, I would be lying if I were to deny that this has been a very difficult 9 months for my family and for myself. Obviously, when you can't leave your house without armed security and armored vehicles, and you're being threatened by the president of the country with prison, and all the invasiveness that they've tried to impose on our private lives, it's obviously difficult. I think the fact that both David and I went through this in the Snowden reporting, when we were threatened by the U.S. government, he was detained by the U.K. government in a notorious incident at Heathrow Airport, has made it a little bit easier because we've done something similar, although this has been much more difficult. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you go into journalism, these are the kinds of stories you want to do. And if you want to confront power, inherent in that is that you're going to be subjected to attacks and risks and dangers. And so while it's not been easy or fun all the time, it's been very gratifying. Brazil is a country I love. I care about Brazilian democracy, and I feel like the journalism we're doing is defending and strengthening it. And that's something that gives me a sense of purpose that makes all the costs worthwhile.
Glenn Greenwald is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and co-founder of The Intercept and The Intercept Brazil. Glenn, thank you so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Greenwald's experience in Brazil is far from unique. All over the world, journalists face dangers from hostile governments. And as civil unrest and protests have grown in places like Hong Kong, Chile, and Lebanon, governments have cracked down on reporters as well as protesters. For more on this, I'm joined by Courtney Raj, Advocacy Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Courtney, we just heard from Glenn Greenwald about being targeted by the Bolsonaro government in Brazil. Before we get into the questions about press freedom, what do you make of the Brazilian government's case against him?
Well, we're definitely deeply concerned about the fact that charges have been brought against Glenn Greenwald essentially for doing journalism. And we've called on the government to refrain from prosecuting him and other journalists for communicating with their sources. This is a really disturbing charge that essentially seeks to criminalize journalistic activity.
In his defense, Greenwald says he didn't cross a line into actually instructing his source. Is that clear to you as well?
Well, I mean, I think it's clear to many, given that the Supreme Court has already determined that Greenwald should not be investigated or prosecuted for his journalistic charge, for his journalistic work. And so the charges should obviously be dropped.
Is this gray area of actually directing sources something we've seen other journalists get into legal trouble for?
Well, it looks very similar to what the charges against Julian Assange are under the Espionage Act, with the U.S. prosecutors essentially trying to make the case that the communication and the way that Assange communicated with his sources amounts to something that is not journalistic and that he was participating in hacks or leaks. And I think it's very similar to what Greenwald is facing in Brazil. And so, you know, it's very problematic if we're going to see governments, especially democratic governments, seek to make routine journalistic work and equate that with espionage or terrorism or other, you know, trumped up charges.
Under the Bolsonaro government, have attacks on journalists in the country increased?
So the Bolsonaro government has presided over some pretty serious rhetorical attacks on journalists. However, Brazil has never been a very safe place to be a journalist. It is one of the countries where journalists have been killed for their work over the past several years, and journalists are murdered with impunity. So it is a dangerous country. What has worsened under Bolsonaro are the outright attacks and vilification of journalists, of the media, attempts to denigrate the role of journalism in the country, online harassment and trolling of journalists, and that sort of thing. And of course, then the use of fake news as a way to pillory and delegitimize journalism.
If we look at other countries where press freedoms are under attack, how is social media being used as a tool for targeting journalists?
So social media has become a really challenging tool, I think, for journalists. On the one hand, you know, it's incredibly powerful for them to do reporting and get their material out via social media. On the other hand, we've seen that leaders around the world in both authoritarian and democratic governments are using social media to bypass journalism. And they're also using social media platforms to undermine journalism, to drown out independent and critical reporting through, for example, troll armies or manipulation of social media platforms and the algorithms of visibility. We've also seen that social media is used to conduct online harassment campaigns of journalists. We've seen this around the world, from President Duterte in the Philippines to Maltese officials in the, you know, before journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia was murdered there. We saw it with President Bolsonaro, where, you know, there are journalists working in Brazil who have had to have police protection, armed bodyguards, because of the threats that have emanated after being singled out by the president. And we've seen that here in the United States as well, where, you know, journalists face increased threats and feel, you know, that they are under greater attacks when they come into the crosshairs of, you know, either the president or another politician's social media.
Given all these examples you just laid out of where it's getting to be more difficult to be a journalist, are there countries that are bucking that trend and making it, creating a more enabling press climate?
I wish I could say that there were bright spots. I think that, you know, Scandinavia, which is typically a bastion of press freedom, continues to be so. But even in, for example, Finland, we saw that a Russian trolling campaign against a journalist there was one of the few cases where we've actually seen a legal remedy to that sort of online harassment. And that obviously was not emanating from the politicians there. We saw a brief improvement in Ethiopia, which for the first time in many years, the prior year, did not have any journalists in jail following a political transition. But I think we're worried about what is actually happening in Ethiopia now and whether or not those initial improvements are actually going to be codified in law. So, you know, we're really not seeing a lot of improvement around the world. What we're seeing is that leaders are learning from each other's playbook, and that there really is a playbook of how to use social media, you know, the fake news epitaph, and use that to delegitimize journalists and undermine critical reporting so that ideally no one will either see it in their news feeds or believe it if they do.
So what's the role of social media companies in this context? Is intimidation something they can curtail or prevent?
Well, the companies do have a role in this, especially in countries where the legal system is not going to provide any sort of remedy. So obviously in countries like the Philippines or in Brazil, where you have political leaders at the forefront of some of this type of online harassment, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to see legal remedy. So we need the platforms to do something. And I think that there is much more that they can do. And we regularly raise cases to the platforms to try to get them to address these on an individual basis. But there are also things that they need to be doing proactively, realizing that there is a link between disinformation campaigns, online harassment, and especially during times of protest or during elections. I think that the design of the platforms in some cases, you know, facilitates this sort of activity, the extremism, the algorithms that favor engagement. And despite many of the platforms prohibiting what they call inauthentic coordinated behavior, nonetheless, we see, you know, firms, PR firms, for example, advertising on these platforms, services that are aimed at manipulating these social media platforms, visibility, likes, you know, fake followers, etc. So there is more that they can do, and they must do more, especially during elections.
I've been speaking with Courtney Raj, Advocacy Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
Yesterday marked 47 years since the Supreme Court legalized abortion in the landmark case Roe v. Wade. Today, the battle over abortion rights has reached a fever pitch. In 2019, the U.S. saw an unprecedented number of laws aimed at limiting people's right to abortion. According to the Guttmacher Institute, 25 new abortion bans were signed into law, primarily in the Midwest and in the South. But there's another kind of restriction that's flown under the radar, so-called abortion reversal laws. States including North Dakota, Oklahoma, and Arkansas have passed laws requiring doctors to tell patients seeking medication-based abortions that the procedure can be reversed if they change their minds halfway through the procedure. The medical establishment says that's not true, and there's no reliable research supporting these treatments. Joining me now is Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University and the author of several books about abortion, including Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present, which comes out in March. Mary, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Mark Herron, senior counsel with the Center for Reproductive Rights. Mark, glad you could join us, too.
Happy to be here.
Mary, how does a medication abortion actually work, and how are anti-abortion activists claiming it could be reversed?
Medication abortion usually requires women or patients to take two pills, mifepristone, which helps to detach a pregnancy from the uterine lining, and misoprostol, which causes contractions. So anti-abortion groups that are promoting these abortion pill reversal laws claim that usually if you take only the first pill in the two-pill protocol and then take pretty significant doses of progesterone, that an abortion won't be completed.
So is the idea, as far as you can tell, that anti-abortion activists are trying to buy time, if you will, in which to allow for someone to have doubts about going through with the procedure?
I think so. And I think the laws are part of a bigger narrative that anti-abortion groups have promoted, which is that women regret abortions. And so the idea here, I think, is to advance that idea and also to suggest that women who feel that way or are encouraged to feel that way by anti-abortion groups, that they can change their minds.
What explains this rise in these, quote, abortion reversal laws?
There are two, I think, primary things that have led to the emphasis put on these laws. The first, I think, is just an increase in the number of women who are using medication abortion to end their pregnancies, and a sense on the part of anti-abortion groups that that number is only going to increase as more states introduce abortion restrictions, and as some states, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, actually ban abortions. It becomes more and more important then for anti-abortion groups to convince women that abortion pills are a bad idea and that abortion pills don't necessarily lead to the end of a pregnancy. The other reason these laws have spread is because of a broader strategy to reverse Roe on the theory that abortion hurts women. The Supreme Court, when previously deciding not to overturn Roe, emphasized the idea that women rely on abortion to attain equal citizenship, whether that's in pursuing economic opportunities or educational opportunities. Anti-abortion groups believe that if the court no longer thinks that, right, if women cannot or should not rely on abortion, then the court will undo Roe. So these abortion pill reversal laws fit into a strategy centered on the idea that abortion is bad for women.
So, Mark, do we have any evidence supporting the claim of these laws that medication abortion can be reversed?
Well, we know that medication abortion, as Mary said, is a two-drug protocol, and if that protocol is followed, it's both extremely safe and extremely effective. It's effective in over 95% of cases, and the rate of serious complications is less than 0.4%. We also know that if only the first drug, mifepristone, is taken and not followed up with the second drug, that there's a high rate of continued pregnancies, up to 50%. So the claims that are being made is that if you introduce high rates of progesterone after taking the first pill, that somehow counteracts the effects of the first pill. But there's absolutely no credible scientific evidence that the progesterone has any effect whatsoever. There was a recent study that tried to actually test this reversal theory using rigorous scientific evidence that double-blinded controlled clinical trial that you would typically see before you would introduce a new treatment. And they actually had, the researchers there had to stop the study after only 12 women took the treatment because three of the women experienced severe hemorrhaging. So what we're seeing is that this quote-unquote reversal treatment, not only is there no science showing its efficacy, in fact, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has said that this is not based on credible evidence, but there are serious concerns with safety.
And the AMA, the American Medical Association, has also actually spoken out about this, correct?
That's correct. The Center for Reproductive Rights is challenging reversal laws in both North Dakota and in Oklahoma. I'm involved in both of those lawsuits. And in our North Dakota case, the American Medical Association has joined as a plaintiff in that case.
Mary, this narrative underlying all these laws, it rests on the idea that people are going to regret having an abortion. What do we know about that?
There was just recently a study published suggesting that very few women do regret abortions. But I think, unfortunately, given the state of the abortion debate, there's really no study that would put those arguments about abortion and regret to rest. So I think there's been a considerable amount of research suggesting that women don't regret abortions, at least for the most part. But anecdotal evidence or questions about what anti-abortion activists would see as bias will mean that arguments about abortion and regret will live on. I think not least of which because they're believed by anti-abortion lawyers to be effective in the courts as a strategy for potentially dismantling abortion rights.
Mark, I'm also wondering what these laws mean for doctors, especially in an ethical or legal sense.
The most critical part of a physician-patient relationship is trust. Patients have to believe that their doctors are giving them sound medical advice and it's advice that they can rely on. And physicians have an ethical obligation toward their patients. And these state laws are requiring physicians to tell their patients about a course of treatment that is not only medically unsound in terms of there's no evidence of efficacy, it's also potentially dangerous. And so it really puts doctors in this Hobson's choice. And the Oklahoma law, for example, actually makes it a felony to not tell your patients about this quote-unquote reversal treatment. And doctors can be fined up to $10,000 a day if they don't post these notices in their waiting rooms. So doctors are now forced, do I risk criminal penalties or do I give my patients false and misleading information and violate my ethical obligations?
Mark Herron is senior counsel with the Center for Reproductive Rights, and Mary Ziegler is a law professor at Florida State University and the author of the forthcoming book, Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Arun.
Thanks.
That's your show for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.